Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 8th of August 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. Apologies for that small technical glitch, but we're very pleased to say that we are here online. Big things about to happen or not, Mike?
Well, it's hard to say. This is this week's Economist magazine. It could happen, they say. With a nice big mushroom cloud with Kim Jong-un on one side and Donald Trump on the other, superimposed into the mushroom cloud. As I say, the headline on the cover is "It could happen," and of course that's taken the mickey perhaps out of Donald Trump's tweet that it won't happen about any possibility of North Korea developing a weapon system which is likely to hit the United States. And of course, as Patrick Henningsen was saying on the Sunday Wire on Sunday evening. Of course, they don't actually have an intercontinental ballistic missile. They've made a couple of attempts at flying a couple of missiles, which don't have any proper guidance system. They aren't actually capable. They don't have the range to get to the mainland United States. So this is all just being ramped up in a really stupid fashion. If we look at the article itself in The Economist, it's entitled "How to Avoid Nuclear War with North Korea," and of course, this is not what they want at all. If you read on down through what they're talking about here, they have a secondary article, "How Nuclear War in North Korea Could Start and How It Might End," and this is a particularly interesting one because it's set in the future, looking backwards at how a nuclear war with North Korea actually started, Brian. So this 3 pages of the magazine. On this history, looking back from 2019 at how the war came about and how many hundreds of thousands of people were killed. And Trump won the war in the end, apparently, according to this forecast. And of course, the UK and Europe was untouched, left to fight over the scraps of whatever remains from this nuclear conflagration. But at the end of this article then, of course, they give the City of London inspired instructions because the only way to avoid this, they say, is to ramp up economic sanctions, not only against the North Korean regime, but also against the Chinese companies that trade with it or handle its money. And they also say that that the United States should formally extend its nuclear guarantee to South Korea and Japan. And at the end of the day, this is the message that The Economist is wanting to push out here, that we've got to increase the sanctions regime, because, of course, that has worked everywhere else has been applied, Brian. We've now got to apply it not only to North Korea, but to any Chinese companies that would trade with North Korea. And we've also got to ramp up the pressure amongst China and the region in general by extending the nuclear guarantees to South Korea and Japan. That's going to work.
It's getting complicated. And we had an MP, I think, talking and saying that we needed better relationships with the Russians, and maybe we needed to work on the Chinese to do that.
That was Frank Field, and he was saying that he was saying that Britain at the moment is playing it wrong with Russia, that we shouldn't be poking a stick at the bear in the way that we are, that in fact we should be looking to improve our relationship with Russia so that we could perhaps steer Russia towards the real threat, which is China.
So playing one country off against another.
This seems to be the plan B, that initially we want to keep the pressure on Russia in the way that we are, but if that doesn't work, then perhaps we want to be sidling up to them and persuading them that Russia's that China's the real enemy. But just speaking of that, at the ASEAN conference, which is taking place in Manila at the moment, Rex Tillerson and Sergey Lavrov met yesterday, and here we see once again that at least the State Department of the Trump administration is keen to encourage positive relationships with Russia, Russia understands how the sanctions situation came about, it seems. And Lavrov said, "We had a lengthy meeting with Rex Tillerson. He wanted to know, first of all, Had he started with this, the details of those decisions which we had to take in response to the law on anti-Russian sanctions adopted in the US Congress. We give certain explanations. Naturally, the sanctions included the illegal seizure of our diplomatic property since December last year, and that cannot be left unanswered. At the same time, we're ready to normalise the dialogue, as he put it. So this is a positive response. He said that contacts on the Syrian settlement between our representatives continue, including as part of agreements reached by Russia, the United States and Jordan on the establishment of the southern de-escalation zone in Syria. We expect our contacts with the United States on other aspects of the Syrian settlement, both military and political, will be continued. As a matter of fact, they've never been interrupted. Certain sections of the Trump administration wanting to improve relationships with Russia, that's a positive step. I don't think it should be viewed in the same vein as Frank Field was presenting by any means.
Yeah.
But
mainstream press and media not reporting any of these real issues that are going on in the relations between
Not
UK often. And Russia. I just wanted to come in there and say, of course, the thing with the report on Korea, this is docudrama. It's a mixture of fact and fiction. BBC particularly good at it. And I noticed that somebody in the chat box is suggesting that when they did some sort of common purpose type courses, this is one of the things that was done. You mix in what is reality with fiction, which I think takes people's minds into a very interesting space.
Isn't that called fake news?
Indeed.
Mm. Okay, financial news then. So, of course, everything is rosy if you believe the UK or US financial press. But this is... Danish financial press, and they're saying, really, we've got a massive financial collapse on the horizon here. They're saying 10 years after the financial crisis struck, the first ominous cracks, bubbles both in the housing sector and the stock market are to be expected. So experts are seeing the first signs of a new financial crisis is how it's being described. But the key point here really comes from Peter Schiff, Managing Director of Euro Pacific Bank. He's saying that this is going to be an even bigger financial crisis than in 2008. And he's pointing out that the Fed only saw sunshine and blue sky, even though there was an enormous storm on the way. Today we have the same situation, but it's bigger. Well, we've been warning about this for quite some time, and it seems to have broken into the mainstream media in one country at least, but there's still... We're still facing absolute dishonesty in this country.
Yes. But the question nobody's asking is why the banks are put forward as being experts on any of this policy and why the banks are able to put in enormous pressure behind the scenes in a political sense.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to, having made that statement, recap on yesterday where we are pointing out individuals who appear to be very powerful in their positions in government. So we had Danuta Gray, and she is here on the gov.uk website saying that she's chair of the People Committee. And she's helping to manage the careers of senior military officers and senior civil servants, including managing talent, behaviour and incentives. And of course, you picked up there, Mike, that if you're going to manage somebody's behaviour, presumably it's going to be a carrot and stick in there somewhere. So who is this woman? She's worked in the telecommunications industry previously, but now she's controlling senior military officers in the UK. So who put her in that position? And what gives her and her commercial colleagues this immense power? We also flagged up this lady, Catherine Brown, and of course she has got direct links through to the banking sector because she was Group Strategy Director of Lloyds, and prior to that she'd been Executive Director Human Resources of the Bank of England. She's Chair of the Cabinet Office People Committee. So our point is, we think we're being run by elected members of Parliament who are there to do the bidding of their electorate. But in fact, what we are seeing more and more, particularly under Theresa May's government, is the fact that we've got the private sector at work. So we picked up on this headline today, The Telegraph, and it said Sir Lyndon Crosby had been paid $85,000 a day for advising on Theresa May's disastrous 2017 election campaign. The headline's a bit misleading because he wasn't paid, his company was. I think they got a little over $4 million altogether for what was quite rightly described as a disastrous campaign. But if you get into the article, this man pops up, Theresa May's former chief of staff, Nick Timothy. And he basically said that, campaign that had been run was not very good. He'd resigned himself and he made some other comments. But the article said that he had helped write the Conservative Manifesto together with Ben Gummer MP. And I wondered what his background and experience would be to do that. This is the comment. He said, Mr. Timothy, who quit Downing Street the day after the election, accepted that the much criticised Conservative manifesto, which he co-authored with Minister Ben Gummer, and which included highly controversial proposals on the funding of social care, might have been too ambitious. So we've got one very interesting man with Ben Gummer creating the whole of the policy. I was fascinated by that. So let's bring him in on screen. And this is actually his background. So we've got Sheffield University politics straight into the Conservative Party. I'm very surprised at his age. He looks a lot older than the birth date, which is on the internet. So I presume that's correct. But this is the CV here. So he goes straight into the Conservative Party, takes a little break out in the financial sector in the city, as you do, Mike.
Yeah.
Not a lot of detail about that. Apologies for the additional born 1980. I think we pinned him down. He then returns to work with May's team. He then leaves at a particular point, 2015, to become the director of the New Schools Network. But he comes back in, works on May's leadership campaign. But in 2017, he resigns. So he's a product of university politics, apparently got no experience in any other sector, but he can hop into education or finance as you do. So we had a little look at the New Schools Network. This is their part of their leadership team. And what are these people doing? Well, they say they're setting up new funded schools for proper free education. And this lady I found particularly interesting because if you have a look at the detail on it, she says that, well, aside from her keenness in education, she goes off and dresses up as a Viking now and again. So I'm pretty impressed with what's going on here. But this particular lady caught my eye. And if we dig into her, we'll actually see that she's got some very interesting links through to the Conservative Party because she was head of the Conservative fundraising campaign. And she's also involved with fundraising for the New Schools Network, not surprisingly, perhaps. But also the Policy Exchange is mentioned here. So I find it interesting that he's hopped across into a network that seems to have got some pretty deep conservative links. So where does this take us? Well, if we bring in the Policy Exchange itself, who was behind that? Well, I think we'll recognise this fellow.
Francis Fraud.
Francis Maud, who was head of transparency in the Conservative Party. That was a fairly opaque transparency, but that's apparently what he did. He said there was a vacuum in Tory policy. Policy Exchange was set up. One of the other men involved was Michael Gove. And then I was very interesting to see that it was actually Nick Bowles MP who came in as their first director. And why should we be interested in Mr. Bowles? Well, if he was in the middle of Conservative policy and the creation of Conservative policy here with Policy Exchange, this is the very same man, excuse me, who was quoted in 2010 the Prime Minister and his deputy, Nick Clegg, want their people power revolution to unleash chaotic effects across local communities. Chaotic, therefore, in our vocabulary, that's the Tory vocabulary, is a good thing. And if Nick Bowles said it, it was reinforced by another Conservative parliamentary candidate, Nick Kruger, who said that the Conservatives plan to introduce a period of, quote, creative destruction in the public services. So now we're getting a very interesting picture because we can see that people next to Theresa May, people creating her set of policies, are the very people linked in to the Conservatives wanting to unleash chaos. Mm. And we certainly seem to be in the middle of that at the moment, Mike.
Absolutely.
So if anybody would like to check that out in more detail, I think there are a lot more questions to be asked about what Mr. Nick Timothy was actually up to. Be very interesting to know where he was working in the city, and does that bring us back into the banking sector that we've already shown working deep in the heart of the Cabinet Office and the Tory political machinery? Well, we'll just end this particular section here, which is, of course, Telegraph headline that says that British judges could still apply European court decisions after Brexit.
No. No, they couldn't do that, Brian.
No. So, we've just captioned that. Theresa May is leading the Brexit with no exit. And I think this is about right. This is treason at work. They have no intention of letting us out of the European Union. Hence, a judge who should be supporting the British Constitution and common law is suggesting that our common law is going to be overridden on occasions by European legislation, or European law at least.
Well, it's funny you mention this because, of course, yesterday we were talking about online security and Matt Hancock's new efforts to make sure that we have full control of our data online. But he has today said that we want the UK to be the safest place in the world to live and be online. Because he's announced new fines for what he describes as essential service operators who have poor cybersecurity records. So they're saying that organisations who fail to implement effective cybersecurity measures could be fined as much as £17 million or 4% of global turnover as part of plans to make Britain's essential networks and infrastructure safe, secure and resilient against the risk of future cyber attacks. So he's launched a consultation today by the Department of Digital, Culture, Media and Sport, and that's going to help to make sure UK operators in electricity, transport, water, energy, health and digital infrastructure are prepared to deal with the increasing numbers of cyber threats. And it's also going to cover other threats affecting IT, such as power failures, hardware failures and environmental hazards. So he said, as it says on screen there, that we want to make the UK the safest place in the world to live and be online, with our essential services and infrastructure prepared for the increasing risk of cyber attack and more resilient against other threats such as power failures and environmental hazards. And then we come on to it, Brian, because then we discover that this is nothing to do with Matt Hancock having an original thought. This, in fact, is only to do with a European directive. And so this European directive, the Directive on Security of Network and Information Systems, was approved by the European Union in 2016, because of course the European Parliament can only approve directives, they can't actually do anything else with them. And so this consultation to decide how to implement the Network and Information Systems Directive, and that's going to be implemented from 2018. Well, Brian, I'm sorry, but this directive was, as I say, agreed in 2016 by the EU. No decision on how to implement it has been made so far. And here we are, several months, allegedly, into the process which is supposed to be taking us out of the EU. And Matt Hancock is now beginning a consultation on how to implement an EU directive. So why is he not starting a consultation on, for example, how this subject fits into our negotiations over Brexit? He's not doing that. And I would argue, as I think you might as well, Brian, because there is no Brexit.
It's Brexit light. Brexit light you can trust because it's had the exit removed.
Okay, it's had the exit, so it's just B then.
Yeah, just
BR rather. Bruh. So it's as simple as that. There can be no other explanation, I think. You don't have to spend money and time consulting on implementation of a directive which will no longer apply 1 year after it's due to be implemented if there was such a thing as Brexit. As I say, surely you put all your efforts into the Brexit process itself. So Brexit, a fraud.
A complete fraud. Where do we go from there?
Good question. North, south. All right.
Mortality, I think it is.
Death. Right. So this is the British Medical Journal. And it's the a report, a new report from the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health by a number of scientists from the University of Manchester and the University of York. Sorry, and it's looking at mortality trends between 1965 and 2015. And what they're saying is that since 1965, 1.2 million more people have died before the age of 75 in the north of England than in the south. So there's a definite divide between the north and south of England, if you take into account differences in population. So they released a few graphs here, and this shows the red line there is northern England, and the blue line is southern England, and that's showing the mortality rates for the ages 45 to 54 per 10,000 people. And you can see that there is a definite higher level of mortality in the north than in the south. But it starts to get particularly interesting once you start looking at younger age groups, Brian, because if you look at the 35 to 44 age group, you find that since 1995, not only is mortality higher in the north, but the gap is getting much bigger. And in fact, if you look at the even younger age group between 25 and 34, a similar picture. So you've got to ask, of course, nobody's actually giving any particular explanation for why this is. They're just taking note of the fact that it is this way. The question is, why is this the case? That is a very good question, and I'm not sure that we know the answer to that yet.
Well, the first thing that comes into my mind is the fact that as we head north, in general, wages lower, unemployment higher, therefore stress levels are going to be higher, possibly diet not as good because people haven't got the money to feed themselves properly. I think I might start looking in that direction. Well, we're going to say a very big thank you to all of our viewers and listeners that have donated. This little card popped through the door today with a donation, so we'd like to use that as a the graphic to say a big thank you to everyone who's donated. And as we always say, we couldn't do what we do without your help and support.
And just a reminder that we are taking a summer break this year, and so there will be no UK column news between the 14th and the 30th of August, and we'll see you back on the 31st. Now, we did mentioned the BBC earlier. It's good to get a dig in to the BBC. But what's interesting is that more and more people seem to be recognising what the BBC is about, Brian, because a couple of little graphics that have appeared have been sent to me. This is one of them. It says, this is what 7 years of Tory growth really looks like. Gas bills up 49%, creche fees up 34%, stamps up 52%, water up 25%, rail fares up 27%, homelessness up 41%, rent up 25%, food up 21%, and debt up to £730 billion. Meanwhile, on BBC Newsnight, it's Venezuela all the way. And another one from the same person, I believe, saying in the sixth richest country in the world, we've got a record spike in crime following unprecedented cuts in police forces. We've got parents subsidising cuts to school budgets. We've got hospitals at breaking point. We've got EU refusing to negotiate with us because we have no plan for Brexit. We've got retirement age increased to 68 and going north pretty quickly. We've got the public sector workers given real world pay cuts. But forget all that. Let's lead with Corbyn and Venezuela. Yep. And this is absolutely the case. And of course, what's going on in Venezuela. Venezuela is being rapidly turned into the next Syria. Now, I'm not suggesting it's going to end up in a Syrian-style civil war, but if you look at the way that the Venezuelan situation is being presented right across the BBC, not just on BBC Newsnight, they're using the same types of propaganda techniques to cover the Venezuela story as they did to cover the Syrian story. And it's good to see people calling them out for it.
Yep. Well, it's really excellent because this is what needs to happen. It needs to be a great many people exposing, asking the questions and simply withdrawing consent. But let's stay with the BBC. And yesterday I tweeted this out because I was so appalled. It was the BBC running an experiment, using young children for that experiment on no more gender, no more boys and girls. Can our kids go gender free? So the BBC literally boasting about what it was doing here. I tweeted it out, 48 retweets there. I'm not sure what the count is at the moment, but I could tell by responses that other people were, I think the word is outraged by what was going on here. So I decided to revisit this. We found a range of papers picking up on it. So I think this has hit home in several directions. So the Daily Star, even no more boys and girls, kids taught how to be gender neutral in classroom tests. Now, these children have come from a primary school on the Isle of Wight. I think many people are disgusted that the staff, the head teacher of a primary school would give his children to be used in what many have said is a pretty dangerous psychological experiment. But what I was interested in was this man, Dr. Javed Abdelmonem, who the BBC seems to be pushing forward as a gender expert. And this is one of the quotes from that article from the doctor himself. He said the children didn't like the toilet. What he's getting at here is that they had to all share the same toilets because they were gender neutral toilets. The girls were like, oh, the boys come out with their bits dancing out and they don't wash their hands. And he thinks this is amusing that we've got young children who already know enough about their identity to want to go to the toilet in private. He's mocking the children and he finds it amusing that very young children, the girls, are coming out with these sorts of comments. So I followed it through. This was the Express. Coming in a bit harder, BBC under fire for using children in social experiment to create gender neutral school. But here's the BBC. The BBC described the show as a bold, engaging and provocative experiment, which is the inspiration of medical doctor Javed Abdelmonem. So the BBC thinks this is all good stuff. This is good documentary. We've got a professional experimenting on children, and we should all be very pleased that the BBC is prepared to be provocative. So according to the BBC, the doctor aims to remove all differences in the way boys and girls are treated to see if after 6 weeks of gender neutral treatment, he can even out the gaps in their achievement across a range of important psychological measures from self-confidence to spatial awareness. Now, this was one comment from Chris McGovern, chairman of the Campaign for Real Education. This is an organisation been doing some very good work to challenge the new liberalism of the school agenda. And he said there may be a case for legal action against the school and the BBC if any child has suffered psychological harm or distress, either in the short term or the long term. And of course, this is absolutely right, because who is to judge what damage this 6 week experiment is going to do to the minds of these children in the short term or, as he says, in the long term? So who is the doctor? Well, it didn't take me long to find him, but I was a bit surprised that he popped up on Al Jazeera site. And go and visit this for yourselves, have a read. But what they're saying is that this man has done tremendous work with Médecins Sans Frontières. He's been out in Lebanon, working with Syria, all sorts of areas. He's a bit of a celebrity, Mike. What I didn't find in that report is anything saying that he was qualified in psychiatry or clinical psychology to be able to judge the dangers of his own experiments. So here he is, Médecins Sans Frontières, again, encourage people to go and have a look. It says, working with Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, had long been a dream for young Javid. So he trained as a doctor in UK, but his big mission has been through Médecins Sans Frontières, and he's a bit of a celebrity, including with Al Jazeera. So more details about him in LinkedIn. Encourage you to go and have a look at this as well. He's president of Médecins Sans Frontières at the moment. He's a member of the Board of Trustees. He's a television presenter, and he's been doing that with Al Jazeera Media Network. He's worked as a doctor in the NHS. He's also been a field doctor with Médecins Sans Frontières. So he's a doctor, he's a celebrity, he works with Al Jazeera, but now he's been let loose on young children to experiment on their minds to see what happens if he messes around with them for 6 weeks.
And no evidence in any of that of any psychological or psychiatric specialism?
None whatsoever. So I thought probably we should dig a little bit deeper to see where we get to. And this is where it gets interesting, because we can have a look on his Twitter page. Most of it is about himself. And of course, he's exceptionally pleased to announce that this BBC experiment on the children is coming out. So we've got him here. But on that Twitter page, he's advertising that he is essentially, his managers are Vivian Klaw. This is an organisation for getting people jobs. And this lady says something quite extraordinary. She says, brain farts and dog pics, sometimes simultaneously, often forgets to use capital letters, work tweets. So this is clearly sophisticated people who are finding this man jobs, Mike. But the BBC managed to find him, and they believe that he's the right man to experiment on the minds of very young children.
Good.
So it was very interesting to see that all of a sudden BBC is saying that, well, Al Jazeera is possibly a terrorist network. And the comment of this article is that Israel seeks to shut offices, Al Jazeera offices, and take the network off the air. And they want to close the Qatar-based broadcaster's office in that country. And they want to revoke its journalists, media and credentials. So I'm a bit puzzled. Which is true? Is Al Jazeera a terrorist organisation? If it is, it's fascinating that the BBC is using a gentleman who's been a presenter with them to work in schools.
No, well, Al Jazeera, of course, has been caught up in the whole Qatari scandal with Saudi Arabia. But you've got to remember, Brian, that Al Jazeera, at least the English-speaking Al Jazeera, employs many, many ex-BBC staff. So it's when Qatar decided to set up the English-speaking Al Jazeera, they hired half of the BBC.
Right. Well, so, that makes it even worse then, doesn't it?
So this explains why the BBC likes Dr. Javid, I'm not even going to...
Abdelmonem.
Yes. So much, because he's working with all their ex-colleagues, probably.
Working with ex-colleagues, so easy to get in the back door and get a job. And because he's trained as a GP, this man is qualified to carry out psychological experiments. I would say to our audience today, if I'm allowed to, that I think that this is an issue big enough for a great many people to take the BBC to task. If, as the BBC is suggesting in their article, Al Jazeera is now a media organisation inciting terrorism, which appears to be what's being said, then could they explain why they're prepared to use Al Jazeera, what's the word, presenters, in order to carry out this school experiment? But aside from that, should we be doing this to the minds of young children? Is this child abuse? I think there's a number of questions that we should ask, Mike. And it would be particularly good if our audience would join us in asking some of those questions. Excuse me. I'll also say that as we've been speaking, some of our audience have done some research on Mr. Timothy. Apparently, he's got a he has got a company which is dealing in abduction or trying to stop abduction, at least. And it's being suggested that he worked in the city in insurance, which is always an extremely good area to get into, because, of course, insurers work directly alongside the largest of the hedge funds and banks. OK, we'll leave it there for today. Thank you very much for joining us. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. Bye-bye. Bye.